I was going to ask you if you had any big plans for 2012.
Well, that's certainly one of them. Yeah. We are really enjoying the incarnation of Foreplay with Chuck Loeb in the guitar chair. He's really injected a tremendous amount of fresh creativity and friendship into the band, and our first outing with him, the Let's Touch the Sky project, has met with a lot of success, and we've had so much fun playing that music in live performance, especially Chuck's new composition. His song Third Degree, which was his kind of first song that he presented to us, that brings the house down every time we play it. Just that alone has given a challenge to all of us to follow up in the spirit of that and see what we can do the second time around with him. So we are all very geared up and actually can't wait to get in the studio to continue that process.
Great. We're really looking forward to that. I'm talking to the legendary Bob James. One of your recent works I really enjoyed was the Angels of Shanghai album. How did that come about? That's a little different.
It seems to be the nature of what I get myself into by always insisting on keeping all the doors open. I have felt throughout my time of having the opportunity to play jazz that one of the great things about it is working with new people and learning from the way they approach music. And I guess always had eclectic tastes. I still have a big appreciation for classical music, and I occasionally perform that. But again, through my experience of going to Japan, I got more and more of appreciation for world music, and there was a period of time about 6 or 7 years ago where I was communicating with a Japanese music business guy about how there was a certain style of Chinese traditional music that was very popular in Japan, and that surprised me because I know that sometimes the relations between China and Japan have been strained, and there are all these complications of cultural differences and political differences and everything. And yet, I always felt that music was one of the great ways to bring people together and to mend some of those problems that people have in trying to understand each other. But when I learned that that there was a big following for this particular kind of Chinese traditional music, which they thought of as kind of like healing music, and it was used a lot in music therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just intrigued about it, and this guy actually invited me to come to Shanghai so that I could hear some of the musicians performing this music. And I had never been to China before at that time, so I was intrigued. And, however, not in the furthest reaches of my mind did I ever think at that time that it would end up absorbing itself into my own music. So I went there and went to the Shanghai Conservatory of Music, and he had arranged to have 5 of what they considered to be the best and most progressive of the students there, but they were all performing on these ancient traditional Chinese instruments. And I just fell in love immediately. The way they approached playing their music was difficult for me to understand and comprehend, and it took me definitely out of my comfort zone, but I was intrigued and hooked almost from the first day. And right at that point, I started to try to imagine how that I could incorporate some of those elements. I thought maybe at first it might only end up being one piece or something, but one thing led to another, and a very good friend, a musician from Korea, Jack Lee, encouraged me with this project, and he was very good at being able to handle the complicated travel logistics and all of that, and so I ended up being able to make a couple of more trips there, and before we knew it, I was deep into doing a CD project.
Wow. It's a really great album, and I think that the ending, the new take on Angela, the Taxi theme, is just so beautiful.
That was one of the most almost crazy things to me, that was a shock when I realized that the melody of my theme from the TV series Taxi, which was couldn't be a more American New York City kind of project that I was asked to write music for, having to do with the atmosphere of the cab driver in New York City and all that. But I realized way after the fact, maybe 20 years after the fact, when I presented that theme to the Chinese kids, that the scale of that it was written on is the very same scale that traditional Chinese music, the five-note kind of minor type scale, and the first seven or eight notes of the melody from the way they looked at it, it could have been a Chinese folk song. And I had no idea. So it was very natural to them, and they ended up showing me or playing for me one of their favorite Chinese folk songs, which translates into being Purple Bamboo.
Mm-hmm.
And in that arrangement, I ended up kind of segueing back and forth between those two pieces. So it once again, I guess I just had to be there in that environment for it to happen. I never could have even conceived that it could have happened in my wildest imagination without actually being there.
Wow. You've always been open to different styles of music. You've done classical. You've worked with the Angel of Shanghai and the world music thing. And your impact on hip-hop is huge. Nautilus is one of the top 10 most sampled songs in hip-hop history. Take Me to the Mardi Gras. These songs were sampled by Run DMC, Public Enemy, Eric B. and Rakim. These are not little groups. If you didn't do your music, hip-hop would be very different. I was wondering, when you first heard your music sampled, what did you think of that at the time, and how have those views changed, or have they?
Yes, they've changed pretty drastically, because when I did first hear it, I couldn't avoid the feeling of being ripped off, or the feeling of being almost like raped, because it was early in the rap era, and there was no organization in terms of licensing music. A lot of the DJs or the rap and hip-hop artists just took stuff, and I think they felt creatively that there wasn't anything wrong with it, that they could just take another piece of music, and as long as they broke it up into chunks, that it changed enough that it became theirs. But that was really not what was going on, and there are reasons why we had protected our music from copyrights, or with copyrights, so that we have some control over how our music is used. So in the early days, I felt like I was almost like waging a battle to retain control over my own destiny. But little by little, it took on this strange life in which I discovered that not only did they not feel like they were stealing from me, but they had the best of the hip-hop artists had a lot of respect for what I did and were fans, and I also discovered that they were bringing my music to a whole generation of people who wouldn't have heard it otherwise. So I definitely entered into some heavy confrontation in terms of straightening out the problems with licensing, so that there was a little bit of control on my part, and that they understand that the record companies and everything had a better structure about how they would ask for permission in advance, so that you didn't get hit by bad surprise and discover that your record was on some real successful thing where a lot of money was being made and you weren't a part of that picture.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been a lot of different variations of that, but just from the standpoint of the flattery that the music found such a completely new audience, it was incredible. It was shocking at the time, and I still shake my head to this day. The song Nautilus, I even myself didn't have any idea how successful that song could be. When I made my record, which was called One, for CTI back in 1974, it was the LP era, and in those days you had a side A and a side B of an LP, and the sequencing was done very specifically emphasizing that what you thought were the best cuts would be the first cut on side A and the first cut on side B, because that would be the thing that disc jockeys would play first, or and even from a technical standpoint, the grooves were wider at the outside of an LP, and so we always felt that the outside cuts sounded better. And then once you got to the inside, where you had narrower grooves, there was not as much bass, and things like that. So Nautilus was the last cut on side B of my first record, which was very clearly like we didn't. Nor did Cree Taylor, the producer. We were not thinking that that cut was going to get played or focused on in any kind of way. And it didn't. There was a track, Night on Ball Mountain, that got a lot of attention at that time. And the track, Feel Like Making Love, both of those cuts kind of made my whole solo career. Wow. And Nautilus was just hidden there on the last cut on side two. And it took another whatever it was, probably at least 20 years before it took on a life of its own.
Yeah, that goes to show, even great albums from 20 years ago, you find something new great about them even later.
Yeah, timing is everything, they say, and I know that things go in cycles in our field, and sometimes the cycles have to do with a song suddenly getting put in a movie, or there are all kinds of reasons why something will come back to life, and different areas of the public will become aware of it that otherwise wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a great, fortunate, lucky, whatever you want to call it, it's a great aspect of creating records, or that they do have a life of their own, and they end up in all different parts of the world. I have the opportunity these days to play in a lot of different countries, and sometimes I'll go into a country and end up getting a request for a song that I'd even forgotten that I had done. Nobody asked for it over here in the U.S., and they'll say, "Oh, gee, that was a song that you did on such and such record back." And I'm sometimes embarrassed to have to admit that I don't even know the song anymore.